time is 1:32. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belch Room 105 of the Thomas Stewart Building in the beautiful capital city of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Monday, March 27th, 2023. Happy Stewards Day, everyone. 156 some odd years ago, the deal was inked on March 30th between Russia and the United States to sell and transfer the territory of Alaska to the United States. And so we are all thankful for that agreement and one of the many reasons why we are all here today. Members present at this meeting are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Bishop, Senator Dunbar will be along shortly, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I would like to welcome and thank our recording secretary, Juliana Singh, today, as well as our LAO moderator, Jake Wade. Today, we have four items on our agenda. First up, Senate Bill 74, Physical Therapy Licensure Compact. Then, Senate Bill 75, Audiologists and Speech Language Interstate Compact. Then, Senate Bill 84, Money Transmission, Virtual Currency. Finally, Senate Bill 45, Direct Health Agreement, Not Insurance. First up, Senate Bill 74. We heard this bill on March 8th when we had an introduction of the bill and took public testimony. Online for questions only, a few experts, Jeff Rosa from the Federation of State Boards of Physical Therapy, Leanne Carruthers from FSBPT, Alaska chapter, and Glenn Saviors is here in the room if we have any questions for her. Here to present a recap of the bill, we have the sponsor, the Honorable Senator David Wilson, together with his staff, Ms. Jasmine. Senator and Jasmine, if you could join us at the table, please state your name and affiliation for the record, and you can recap the bill for us and all of its fans watching from home.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is David Wilson, Senator for District D.
And Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson.
Thank you both for being here today. Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I can do a quick recap of both these pieces of legislation together. We could do that. Senate Bill 74 is an act establishing the Interstate Compact for Physical Therapy Compact, and Senate Bill 75 is the act establishing the Audiologist and Speech Language Interstate Compact. Both these compacts are a little different than the other compacts that we've heard a lot of information on already in this building. These compacts allow the state to sort of retain that autonomy and allow the state to continue to set the regulations and fee structures for the interstate compact piece of this, as well as for the folks that are normally applying for licensure under our state regulations. And that's pretty much about it, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Let the record reflect that Senator Dunbar has joined us at 1:35. At this time, does anyone have questions for Senator Wilson or Ms. Martin? At this time, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 74. Is there anyone in the room or online that wishes to testify? Seeing and hearing no one that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 74, I will close public testimony and bring the bill back before the committee. Is there further committee discussion? Seeing none, what is the desire of the committee? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 74, work order number 33-LS0138/S-SITKA-B, be reported from committee and with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations in the spirit of Seward Alaska Day.
Very good. Is there objection from the committee? Seeing and hearing no objection, Senate Bill 74 version /S moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the documents. The record. Next up, Senate Bill 75. We first heard this bill again on March 8th when we had an introduction to the bill and took public testimony. Once again, as a reminder, online, four questions for this bill. If folks have questions, Susan Adams with the American Speech Language Hearing Association, Nahale Kalfas with the American Speech Language Hearing Association, and Glenn Saviors once again is here with us in the room. Here to present a recap of this bill, the Honorable Senator David Wilson and his staff, Jasmine Martin. Once more, for the record, tell us what this bill does and why you're bringing it forward today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Senate Bill 75 is establishing, I'm sorry, for the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator from District G. Again, Senate Bill 75 establishes the Act of Audiologists, Speech Language Pathologists, Interstate Compact. Again, this just helps promoting cooperation among the states, interstate compact licensures, help increase quality of care by decreasing burdensome to licensing while maintaining the rigorous licensing standards and our own state sovereignty. And that's about the gist of the bill.
Are there questions from members of the committee for the bill sponsor? Seeing and hearing none, at this time I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 75. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 75? I have two testifiers. First up, Susan Adams. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Bjorkman. I don't need to testify today. I can be here to answer questions as to the compact and how it works for the committee if they would like that. I am from the American Speech Language Hearing Association, and we are here in support of this bill.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony and being willing to stand by for questions. Next up on my list, as being listed as wanting to testify, and you certainly can have the opportunity. Ms. Kalfas, you are up.
Yes, thank you so much, Chair and members of the committee. I am here in the same capacity that Susan Adams is here to act as a subject matter expert to answer questions. I am the general counsel of the Speech, Language, Pathology, and Audiology Interstate Compact, and I'm also legal counsel with the Council of State Governments, and we are in support.
Thank you for being here today. Is there anyone else who would wish to testify for Senate Bill 75? Seeing and hearing no one else to come before the committee to testify on Senate Bill 75, I will close public testimony and bring the bill back before the committee. Is there further committee discussion? What are the wishes of the committee? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 75, work order number 33, LS0139, /B, as in Bravo, be reported from committee with the attached fiscal note and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection? Seeing no objection, Senate Bill 75, version /B, moves from committee. We'll take a brief at ease while we sign the documents. We're back on the record, 146 here in Belcher Room 105 at the Thomas Stewart Building. Next up on today's docket is Senate Bill 84, We first heard this bill on March 6th when we had an introduction of the bill and took public testimony. There were some questions during the bill presentation prior to setting the bill aside. Today on the Teams Hub, we have Director Rob Schmidt and Tracy Reno with the Division of Securities and Banking for a recap of the bill. As a side note, members have a sectional reference document and additional public testimony documents before them in their bill packet. Rob and Tracy will not be going over the reference document today. If Mr. Schmidt and Ms. Reno could please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your recap of the bill.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Robert Schmidt. I'm the Director of the Division of Banking and Securities.
Welcome to Senate Labor and Commerce. Please begin your recap.
Thank you. Members of the committee, thank you for taking up Senate Bill 84 on money transmission. I previously provided a PowerPoint presentation with data on the growth of this industry. To very briefly recap, money transmission is a $5.8 billion industry to, from, and within Alaska. About two-thirds of that industry is end-to-end payments, mostly by mobile payment applications such as PayPal, Cash App, Apple Pay, Google Pay, and the like. The legislature passed the current money transmission law in 2007, and it took effect in 2008. It was written in the mid-2000s. At the time the current law was written, mobile payments did not exist. iPhones did not exist. Cryptocurrency did not exist. Dean Fleer, the division's senior most money transmission examiner, joined the division in 2011. At that time, there were about 30 licensed money transmitters. Now that number has grown to 168 licensed money transmitters, but division staffing for this industry remains the same. Senate Bill 84 resulted from a joint industry regulator approach. I understand that we have several members of industry available to speak to the bill, and I encourage members of the committee to hear from them. We've received many thoughtful questions in our discussions around Senate Bill 84. Some of those have been asking about federal preemption. States have regulated money transmission for over a century. 55 states and U.S. territories regulate money transmission. There is no state advocating for federal preemption, not California, not Texas, not Massachusetts, not Florida. No industry trade group or major market participant is advocating for federal takeover of this space. Alaska would be a minority of one if we were to ask for federal takeover of money transmission. While there are some aspects of the industry overseen by the federal government, no federal regulator performs overall safety and soundness examinations of the money transmission industry. That function is performed by the states. The Division of Banking and Securities responds almost 1,000 times per year to your constituents when they have questions or concerns on the financial industry. We are, by far, in a better position than the federal government to regulate the money transmission industry and protect Alaskans. It would diminish Alaska's sovereignty to yield this important industry to the federal government. With these comments, I would like to turn to the Division's Chief of Examinations, Tracy Reno.
Thank you, Director. Are there questions for Mr. Schmidt from the committee? Seeing none, Ms. Reno, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
For the record, my name is Tracy Reno, Chief of Examinations with the Division of Banking and Securities. SB 84 amends Title VI, Chapter 55 of the Alaska Money Services Uniform Act. We have provided a slideshow reference document that provides a summary of the sections in this bill. We hope that this document will be a useful tool as you and your staff review the elements of this legislation. The purpose of this bill is to replace existing money state transmission laws, to modernize licensure requirements, to add model language for virtual currency industries, to allow the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development to coordinate with other states in the regulation, licensing, and supervision, to standardize the types of activities that are subject to licensing, and to modernize safety and soundness requirements for money transmission. You will see a lot of repeal and reenacts because this bill is adopting a model law. This bill conforms with the model law by providing application requirements for a money transmitter license and allows the department to change or update forms to be consistent with licensing requirements in the Nationwide Multi-State Licensing System, or NMLS. This is important because companies that transmit money don't want 50 different sets of laws to follow. Money transmitters spent 2 years drafting the model law with state regulators. This bill reduces regulatory burden by streamlining the initial application and renewal processes so that they are the same every year and in every state. Our licenses want Alaska statutes to be uniform with the rest of the country. It's less paperwork for the companies, requiring less staff. It gets their license approved faster so that they can get their businesses up and running, and says Alaska is open for business. This bill conforms with the model law by changing license renewal, renewal reporting, and renewal terminology. Fees collected at the time of renewal will change with this bill. Fees are currently set in regulation, and Section 52 ensures that fees collected are sufficient to cover the cost and to do the work. An annual renewal fee will be based on the licensee's total volume of money transmission to, from, and within Alaska. A good example of this is currently a licensee that transmits $100,000 each year pays the exact same renewal fee as a licensee that transmits $1 billion a year. There are currently 168 licensed Alaska money transmitters who each pay $1,000 annually to renew their license. No matter their size, their complexity, or their geographic location, they all pay the same flat $1,000 annual renewal fee. We will take a special consideration for small mom-and-pop businesses that ensure that the first tier is not a barrier to entry for these small businesses. Having the details of renewal fees in regulation will allow us to update the fees charged to cover the regulatory costs of supervision and keep pace with growth and innovation in the industry. The proposed amendments to ASO 655850 would create a tiered assessment for renewal fees. The assessment would have several tiers with a range of volume transmitted annually and would take a percentage to calculate the renewal fee. The division has been researching what some other states' assessments look like, and the hourly cost of examinations would no longer be billed for those examinations, which are thousands of dollars, and they'll be covered as part of the new tiered assessment renewal fee. Expenses for travel would still be billed. This should reduce the regulatory cost of small money transmitters, providing businesses certainty when planning for their annual budgets. This bill conforms with the model law and will protect Alaska consumers by running criminal background checks on people who control or run a money transmitter company. These background checks will be conducted automatically at application through the NMLS, keeping bad actors from operating the companies that we license and saving hundreds of hours of DBS staff time. This bill conforms with the model law to add new sections regarding virtual currency derived from the Uniform Law Commission's language from the Uniform Regulation of Virtual Currency Businesses Act. It uses standard uniform language and it provides a foundation to regulate virtual currency. This allows the division to regulate virtual currency and adds virtual currency to the definition of money transmission. Details of what is and is not considered licensed activity are provided in the bill. It details a list of exempted activities for things like online gaming and provides disclosure requirements so that Alaska consumers know where to go when they have a complaint. This bill updates enforcement provisions for consistency with the model law regarding the suspension and revocation of a license. It amends civil penalties, allowing the department to cover regulatory costs by assessing its costs and expenses for investigations and allowing a broader spectrum of orders to be issued. This amendment will allow staff to use network supervision, working with other states, to jointly conduct examinations, to investigate and take multi-state enforcement action on bad actors. These amendments also ensure that in the case of a bankruptcy, that the funds entrusted to a money transmitter to send are the consumer's property, not the company's. The licensee will be prohibited from using these funds as assets on their financial statements. While this bill follows the model law, a few modifications were made to ensure it was the right fit for Alaska. As an example, related to net worth requirements, in the model law, the net worth requirement starts at $100,000. After listening to small businesses and other stakeholders last session, the division reduced the net worth requirement to $35,000, as this is more appropriate for Alaska. This bill also allows the department to exempt applicants or licensees from the net worth requirements. Why is this bill important? Last year, Alaskans sent or received 31 million money transmission transactions worth $5.8 billion. This bill will protect Alaska consumers. It will reduce regulatory burden. It adopts a model law that industry drafted with state regulators. It will protect Alaska's sovereignty by creating uniform statutes across the country. And this bill will allow the division to have the ability to update fees and activities that require a license in regulation to keep up with technology and the innovation in this ever-evolving financial industry. Events of the last year have demonstrated the need for modernization of Alaska's money transmission laws. We appreciate the committee's work on this important issue and hope we can continue working together to advance this legislation. Thank you for your time today and the opportunity to testify on behalf of this legislation. We are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Very good. Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I don't have a question, but I just wanted to say that when we had the last hearing, I understood the bill for the most part, but I had a really hard time understanding crypto. And I want to publicly thank you, Director Schmidt, and the other four members, Tracy, and the other four members of your staff, because you spent an hour with me, and it really helped a lot. And I almost feel like an expert, not, but it was just, it was really, really great, and I so very much appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator.
You are most welcome.
Other questions or comments or Ms. Reno or Mr. Schmidt? Okay, thank you very much for that recap. It's very helpful. At this time, I will open public testimony on Senate Bill 84. Is there anyone in the room or online who wishes to testify today? I have a few folks listed online wishing to testify. First up is Lacaw Peacock.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Laka Peacock. I'm representing a business that I am part owner of called Huayana Card. And we are based out of Nome, Alaska. We were started there in 2014. And we're a prepaid card business, and we have about 1,500 cardholders, basically ranging from Koktovik down to Neustuyahok. We're all in rural Alaska villages that have no traditional banking services. We're Alaska Native-owned business, like I said, based out of Nome. And basically, in a nutshell, since 2014, we've been bringing basic banking services to these small villages by allowing cardholders to walk into their local store, get a card or a replacement card without having to wait, you know, 3+ weeks for a card to arrive in the mail. We also allow them to walk into the local store and take a check or a money order. Maybe they sold, you know, some Native arts and crafts or something, and they can deposit it right at the store. Funds are made available immediately. And so we are in support of this bill for two main reasons. And I think the best way I can explain it is by sharing a story of our first bank examination. And when the examiner came to Nome, Alaska, flew all the way there and informed me that we'd be paying for her airfare, her hotel stay, her car rental, and every hour she was on the clock while there, so it would behoove us to have everything ready. And then when she arrived, told me that she had just finished auditing Google Pay, and now she was on to my business. And at the time, when I was first starting this business, I didn't realize that we were on the same playing field. Every single piece of paperwork, all the fees, everything, as Google Pay. And so over the years, we've continued to operate difficult. It hasn't been easy. We're still around, obviously. We've pushed for these regulations, you know, to be reduced for, you know, $100,000 business compared to Google Pay, $1 billion business, primarily on the fee side of things. You know, with our annual renewal fees, our bonding fees are the same. My exam fees, I think we earlier found out, you know, we paid like $20,000 just in exam fees, which is, I think, as much as PayPal has paid. And then we're also required to do full financial audits every single year, which usually runs me about $3,500. And so, you know, just doing a business in rural Alaska alone is difficult. And these barriers to entry, you know, if they could be brought down somewhat on the regulatory side and on the fee side, just as we have for larger banks, you know, like credit unions versus national banks and things like that, it would allow us to stay in business and hopefully allow maybe some more banking type businesses such as ours to either expand or other ones to start. In rural Alaska, as far as I know right now, we're the only place doing this. Alaska Commercial Company tried this same thing back about 15 years ago, and they bombed out. It's extremely difficult, and we're usually kind of hanging on by a thread ourselves. So that's mostly what I have to say today. If there's any questions, I can answer them.
Laka, thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from members of the committee? Hearing none, we will move on to Matthew Lambert. Mr. Lambert, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Matthew Lambert. I am Deputy General Counsel for Policy at the Conference of State Bank Supervisors. Every state has a banking department. We are the association for all those banking departments collectively. I'm here to testify in support of the bill and serve as a witness for any process questions for how the Money Transmission Modernization Act came about. I can probably also answer any detailed questions if need be. But ultimately, this is one of those bills that, because of the way we did it, should be win-win-win. It should reduce regulatory burden for industry. It should modernize requirements for regulators, including making it easier for regulators to work together and more efficiently. And it should allow for the states to continue to serve as the laboratories of innovation. States have been the sole regulator in this industry for over 100 years. And it's not a coincidence that because states have taken the lead and allowed for innovation in this space, that we have hundreds of companies looking to try to enter it and have a competitive framework. Now, ultimately, the challenge for making this law, putting it together, is to be able to have the kind of flexibility needed to serve companies that only operate in one small area, all the way up to some of the largest companies in the world. Google was cited. Google has a money transmission license. And then everybody in between. And I think that the way Alaska has amended their current law and integrated the Money Transmission Modernization Act has accomplished that. And I am happy to be here and answer any questions as needed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lambert. Are there questions from members of the committee? I have a question, Mr. Lambert. The parent model legislation, as well as the Alaska version of this legislation before us today, how would this legislation prevent something like what happened with FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried from happening again?
So with FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, they started moving money fraudulently across global borders, which we can't prevent at the state level, even the national level. You know, the United States can't prevent fraudulent transactions in Singapore. But what you can do is ring-fence U.S. assets. So if a company like FTX or another global company, doesn't have to be crypto, has a U.S.-based licensee, in all likelihood, they are going to create a U.S.-based corporation or LLC, and that's the entity that becomes licensed for the United States. Now, that U.S.-based entity ends up having the net worth, permissible investment, and bonding requirements as applicable to U.S. customers. So you'll notice in, you know, the fallout of FTX and another company, Voyager, that the U.S. subsidiaries did not empty out. They got caught up in the bankruptcy, but the funds were there in strange fashions, don't get me wrong, but they are protected by the permissible investments and ultimately the net worth requirements, because the net worth requirements also end up being a means of incentivizing a more simple balance sheet, if you will. So with those regulatory requirements in place and modernized so that they scale with the size of the company and the activity that they're doing, you end up doing a better job of protecting U.S. consumers. So that's the long and the short of how this helps protect U.S. customers from those kinds of scenarios.
Thank you. Other questions? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony today. Up next.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Schmidt.
This is Robert Schmidt. If I may elaborate very briefly on the previous question presented.
Yes.
A common feature of the crypto bankruptcies we saw last year was that in each of the noteworthy crypto cases, customer accounts had been pledged as assets of the company to the company's creditors. That is to say, if I had crypto at FTX, my crypto had been pledged by FTX to somebody else. This bill contains a prohibition that a customer account cannot be pledged as collateral to the exchange's creditors. That is one of the great tensions that we're seeing in all of the crypto bankruptcies, that customer accounts were pledged as collateral, even though the customers thought that their money was their money.
Very good. Thank you for clearing that up. Other questions? Next up, Adam Atlas. Mr. Atlas, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I'm Adam Atlas, here representing the Money Services Business Association, to provide comments and be available for questions. The Money Services Business Association, or MSBA, is grateful for the opportunity to comment on SB 84. The Money Transmission Modernization Act, which will revise, of course, the legislation applicable to money transmitters in the state of Alaska, will codify the Money Transmission Modernization Act, or Model Act, that was referenced in earlier comments. The MSBA is one of the nation's largest trade associations focused on non-bank money services business industry. Our membership includes licensed money transmitters, their agents, authorized delegates, payment processors, international remittance companies, bill payments companies, and virtual currency exchanges as well. Many of our members do business in Alaska and support your constituents with their businesses. I'm here fulfilling the shoes of our executive director, Kathy Tomasovsky, who was unable to attend today. Specifically, our comments on the bill, Mr. Chair. The MSBA is in favor of the bill. The MSBA supports the rolling out of the model law because it provides significant benefits to customers, states, and industry alike. The MSBA participated in weekly calls with regulators and industry members for almost 18 months through a collaborative consensus to come up with the model law. We also believe that customers will benefit. Customers of money services businesses in the state of Alaska will benefit from dealing with money transmitters in Alaska that are regulated in a way that is consistent with how those suppliers are regulated in other states. We also believe the industry will benefit because the industry benefits from greater clarity in operations and supervision and reducing the complexity of complying with state-specific laws and the need to comply with duplicative oversight requirements. We also believe that this new law will encourage suppliers to make more services available in the state of Alaska than would otherwise be the case. We also believe that this new law will help serve the underbanked consumers by benefiting from access to a financial system that would be supplied through mobile or online products that are increasingly popular in states outside of Alaska. We also support the idea in this bill that the fees would be set by the regulator, so as to give the regulator the ability to adjust them as required, and in a way that is commensurate with the volume of business, so that a small local single state money transmitter that has a smaller amount of volume would pay lower fees than a large national money transmitter with a very much larger volume. Finally, as our final comment, we believe there'll be greater efficiency under the Model Act because it empowers the states to use technology to apply data analytics and share resources under a network system. Those are our comments, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Atlas. Are there questions from members of the committee? Seeing none, we appreciate your presentation today. Is there anyone else in the room or online who wishes to testify to Senate Bill 84? Seeing and hearing no one else wishing to testify on the bill, I will close public testimony. If members have amendments to Senate Bill 84, please contact my office before close of business on Wednesday. We'll get those set to go. As a reminder, if members of the public have written testimony on this or any bill, please submit your testimony to the committee at slac@akleg.gov. Once again, that is slac@akleg.gov. And we'll get your testimony entered into the record. For any of the testifiers that spoke today, if you have written remarks that you would like to submit, please email those as well, and we can get those to our recording secretary to make sure that the record is accurate with your testimony. That email address again is slac@akleg.gov. We are going to set this bill aside at this time, and we will take a brief at ease while we get ready for our next bill. The record 219. And next up on our schedule today is Senate Bill 45, Direct Health Agreement, Not Insurance. Here to present the bill, we have bill sponsor Senator David Wilson. Senator, please thank you again for joining us at the table with your staff, Jasmine Martin. State your name and affiliation for the record and proceed with the presentation of the bill.
Mr. Chair. For the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District N, and with me is
Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, and the committee for hearing Senate Bill 45 this afternoon. Senate Bill 45 allows patients, providers to enter into a direct health care agreement in Alaska. A direct health care agreement is an agreement between a patient and a provider for health care services. The terms of these agreements are spelled out within their contracts, and the patient pays a flat fee, a periodical fee, in exchange for routine visits, access to their provider, and other specified services within that contract. A huge portion of the healthcare provider's time and their team's time is spent on insurance billing and other administrative tasks around billings. Direct healthcare agreements remove this third-party middleman. There is no third-party skimming from profits off the patient's provider relationship. And direct healthcare agreements have many benefits. They reduce the bureaucracy in allowing patients to pay a flat fee for the routine care rather than billing insurance each for an every visit. We all get those wonderful pieces of mail for the explanation of benefits and many different bills. This would eliminate that additional paperwork for patients to receive. Patients have greater access with their doctors. The patients have longer visits with their doctors and also often on a shorter notice. Doctors aren't focused on insurance sideboards and instead focus on patients' care. Doctors benefit from a higher morale. Doctors who enter practice because they want to help people, not to do a bunch of paperwork. Patient-provider relationships are strengthened when the direct health care providers spend more time with their patients, less time on those administrative tasks, again, such as billing. With that, Mr. Chair, we'll have Ms. Jasmine Martin go into a little deeper explanation with the sectional, and then if will the committee move into invited testimony from our folks that we have here on the line. And also, I believe we have a delay with one of our folks here that was going to also be in the room for questions, but we feel that we can probably answer those questions. That was having Director Wingheyer.
Very good. Before you begin, Ms. Martin, Senator Gray Jackson has a question.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Excuse me. Did I hear you say that this bill eliminates EOBs?
No. This just eliminates, well, if you had a direct health care provider agreement outside of insurance without going through insurance, yes, you wouldn't have an explanation of benefits because the benefit would be basically with your health contract. So that's just one less piece of paperwork that you would get.
May I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
May.
Well, I get electronic EOBs, and I like them. So I'm still a little bit confused.
Yes, for the record, Senator Wilson, through the chair, Senator Gray Jackson, this is not insurance, and so this would be separate from getting an EOB. If someone did not have insurance, for example, and just had a direct health care agreement with a provider, then there would not be an EOB because there would not be an insurance company involved with that service of rendered by that physician or health care entity.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Ms. Martin.
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. As Senator Wilson noted, a direct health care agreement is agreement between a patient and provider for health care services. It works similarly to a membership subscription, such as to use a simple example, a gym membership. You pay for access during a gym membership, you pay for access to the building, you pay for access to the equipment at the building. You're paying a flat monthly fee. It's not going to be a surprise what that amount is, but you're paying for specific things within that building. You're not paying for access for the gym across the street. You're not paying in case you want some other services that aren't there. You're just paying for access to that particular place. So these agreements are only between a provider and a patient. There's no third party participating like you have with an insurance situation, and no one profiting from that agreement. In the bill, you'll see that employers are allowed to pay for these agreements, but they're not actually party to these agreements. They're just paying the bill for it. So these agreements are not necessarily specifically prohibited by state law right now, but our laws are drafted broadly enough that these agreements appear to fall under our insurance statutes. And so I'll get more into this a little bit in the sectional analysis, but it's currently the official opinion of the Department of Commerce that these agreements are under the insurance statutes and need to be regulated as such. And this bill clearly defines what these agreements are and why they're not under the insurance statutes. So how are direct health care agreements different from insurance or health maintenance organizations or medical services corporations, which also fall under insurance statutes? There's a couple reasons. They're not agreements that insure against risk. These services are fees are charged for services that are clearly defined. There's no third party. HMOs, MSCs, and insurance all contain a middleman acting between the patient and provider. And the periodic fee is charged at the end of the period. Instead of prepaying in case you need service, you pay in errors for support already received. And with that, I'm happy to go into a sectional analysis.
Are there questions before we do that? Sectional would be great. Thank you.
So for the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. This sectional is for version U of the bill. Section 1 adds a new section into our Title 21 insurance statutes, direct health care agreements. This section gives clear guidance to the Division of Insurance on what is not insurance. Section A here allows a provider and a patient to enter into a direct health care agreement and stipulates that Medicaid recipients are not eligible to enter these agreements. Section B clearly lays out what this written document, this agreement, must contain. So it must describe the services the patient is entitled to. It must specify the amount of the periodic fee, the length of the period, and any additional fees the provider may charge. It must include contact information for a representative of the provider that is responsible for patient complaints and for patients' requests for amendments to the agreement. It must state the agreement is not health insurance and prominently state that these agreements are outside our insurance protections. Section C allows the patient to cancel a direct healthcare agreement within 30 days of entering it for no reason, or not for any specific reason, but they can cancel within 30 days of entering. Section D set terms by which a healthcare provider may immediately terminate a direct healthcare agreement. Section E specifies that a patient may terminate the direct healthcare agreement immediately if the provider violates the terms of the agreement. Section F specifies that a provider may change the fee only once a year, and they have to give 45 days notice to do so. If they set notice that they're going to be changing the fees, then someone can cancel their agreement with no penalty. Section G specifies that a patient or provider can terminate an agreement with at least 30 days notice. Section H specifies when a provider may charge a termination fee, and so that's if they cancel under C or G here. The provider may charge a cancellation fee, but that cancellation fee cannot be more than 1 month's periodic fee. Section I specifies that a patient must pay the periodic fee prorated through the day of termination if they cancel under F or G. Section J specifies that the patient is billed by the provider at the end of the period covered by the fee. And this is a really important section to this bill. It accomplishes two things. It helps differentiate the agreement from insurance, so patients are paying for services received rather than paying in case something happens in the future. And it protects the consumer. It transfers that risk of default to the provider. So if the patient doesn't pay, the provider's out, as opposed to if the patient pays at the beginning of the month and then the provider doesn't provide services, the patient would be out. So it makes it so that the provider would be the one out if the patient doesn't pay. Section K allows an employer to pay the periodic fee on behalf of an employee. Section L specifies the direct healthcare agreement is not subject to Title 21 or insurance statutes, but is subject to other consumer protection and regulation. Section M specifies that a direct healthcare agreement is not insurance and should not be regulated as such. And this gives clear direction to the Division of Insurance. What's contained in this first section here, these are the bounds of these agreements. If someone is trying to step outside of them and violate them, that's when the Division of Insurance might need to be stepping in. Section N is the definition section. And then Section 2 adds a new section to our Trades and Commerce's trades practices. This section is here as a patient protection piece. So a lot of legislation that gets passed is based on civil litigation, and that is the enforcement mechanism. This actually puts an enforcement mechanism under the Unfair Trades Practices Act. Section A here specifies that a provider may not decline to enter or terminate a direct healthcare agreement solely based on a patient's status within a protected class. Section B specifies that a provider may decline to enter an agreement if they are unable to provide the care the patient needs or their practices in that capacity. Section C specifies that a provider may terminate a direct healthcare agreement with a current patient based on their health status only if the provider is not able to provide the services the patient requires. Section D, this is a false advertising clause, and so this prohibits the provider from advertising incorrectly what the benefits of a direct healthcare agreement are, and it specifically prohibits them from advertising that these agreements are insurance. They're not insurance. Section E is a definition section. And then Section 3 adds these as a violation of the Unfair Trades Practices Act. And that is the conclusion of the sectional analysis here.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Senator Wilson, thanks for being here. Do you have any idea how many providers are interested in providing this service?
Through the chair, Senator David Wilson, for the record, We don't have an exact number. We do have a couple of folks that may have provided letters of testimony. I believe we have one clinic which is operating in Eagle River, Mat-Su, and in Anchorage is one of those providers. I think that's Capstone. And I believe maybe Pete Deemer might be able to answer some of those questions as well for invited testimony, as he's an attorney for some of these physician clinics.
Great. Thank you very much.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this section, I was looking at Section H and then cross-referencing it with C and G. I guess I, for you, Senator Wilson, I guess I'm wondering why allow the provider to charge any termination fee? So C is clear that any outstanding fees or costs must be, you know, must be covered by the patient. And we give both parties the right to, with 30 days notice, sort of sever this relationship, but only, you know, only the provider can charge the additional fee. Why have a termination fee? Why allow a termination fee at all?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, and Pete Deemer might be able to go into a little bit more detail here. The only scenarios where a provider is allowed to charge a termination fee is when the patient initiates the cancellation. They're not allowed to charge a cancellation fee if they are the ones to initiate that cancellation.
Right. But, I mean, so you have to do a 30 days notice. So presumably you have to pay for an additional month of service. Why allow them to charge an additional month without, you know, an additional termination fee that's equal to a full month of service, potentially equal to a full month of service?
For the record, Jasmine Martin, unless Senator Wilson wants to elaborate, it might be useful to have Pete Deemer join in the conversation here.
And, you know, Senator David Wilson, for the record, many entities, same to recoup the cost, to replace, you can only see so many providers. Most providers can only see so many patients within a time frame just because of the cap of services, and it just allows that time to recoup. This is something that you agree to when signing this contract, so it's not a surprise to anybody. These definitions will be explained to the individual, but as Ms. Martin said, I think that Pete Deemer could probably go a little bit more into detail on the cancellation fees and how that might work in terms of a practicing physician's office. But many contracts that provide just a service contract provides cancellation service fees. And this is just being within standard practice of just normal service cancellation fees and practices.
And for the record, Jasmine Martin, again, it doesn't require a provider to charge a cancellation fee. And the written agreement has to contain any cancellation fees. So a patient is going to know before they even enter the agreement if they will be charged a cancellation fee if they terminate their agreement before their specified time period.
Are we going to hear from, Mr. Chair, are we going to hear from, is it Mr. Deemer, as you said?
Yes.
Yes.
In invited testimony or?
Yes.
Okay. Maybe I'll ask that question too. I mean, I hear what you're saying in terms of, you know, it's a standard practice in other industries. We have sort of a unique situation where we're trying to set up here, or is being set up already, in a really highly regulated industry where there's also a very large disparity in sort of information and relative power between these providers and their patients typically. And so, I mean, we are saying, you know, you need 30 days notice, for example. So we get to that level of specificity, and we basically require the payment of all fees and fines by the patient. So there are going to be at least a month more of fees. It seems like we could also protect consumers by eliminating the possibility of a termination fee. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? Okay, and this time we will go to the invited testifiers. First up, Pete Deemer. Mr. Deemer, please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
For the record, my name is Pete Deemer, and I am a healthcare attorney with the law firm of Clayton Deemer, and I've been assisting the sponsor with the language of Senate Bill 45. Senate Bill 45 is an opportunity for the legislature to make really a very focused and limited scope in Title 21. in order for Alaska to fully embrace the concept of tribal health care agreements. Right now, Title 21 contains multiple definitions of healthcare insurer, healthcare maintenance organization, medical service corporation, and insurance, which were created at a time before direct healthcare agreements and the concept of direct healthcare even existed. And arguably, these definitions are so broadly crafted that this legislation is necessary to provide a clear safe harbor to providers and patients who desire this alternative arrangement. It's important to understand that this legislation is designed to be a safe harbor. It is not designed to replace insurance, and it is not designed to replace the existing robust regulation of healthcare providers under their professional licensing rules, and it is designed to work in concert with the existing consumer protection rules within the Department of Law under the Unfair Trade Practices Act. And if I could, I would like to address Senator Dunbar's question. I appreciate that question on cancellation fees. I believe Senator Wilson stated accurately that the concept behind a cancellation fee is potentially to cover the cost, the administrative cost of onboarding moving patients from panel of a direct healthcare provider practice. And these fees could only be, and they are not required, as Ms. Martin stated, but they could be charged if stated within the direct healthcare agreement. And they cannot be charged in any event if the provider were to initiate termination. So, for example, in subsection C, Charlie, this is what allows the patient to change their mind within 30 days of entering one of these agreements and exit. The other termination section, which appears later in the bill there, is the 30 days notice. So if 6 months in, a patient decides that they want to discontinue the services, they can give the 30 days notice. And again, these fees, cancellation fees, are permissive. They're not required. And I would suggest that the market will quickly sort out whether or not they're effective. And with that, I'd be happy to respond to any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Deamer. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Mr. Deamer, thank you for being here. Why would a provider choose to terminate a contract with someone?
Well, through the chair, I appreciate that question as well. Right now, the provider, patient, and we'll just use physicians as a simple example, the physician-patient relationship is governed by existing Alaska regulation, which has adopted the American Medical Association 2016 Code of Ethics. And that 2016 Code of Ethics and its interpretive guidance is what provides the sideboards for the patient-physician relationship and when a physician might terminate that relationship. And there may be any number of reasons why that relationship becomes dysfunctional. It's rare in my experience as a healthcare attorney, but it can occur. For example, if the patient becomes abusive to the provider or to the provider's staff or is habitually refusing to follow the provider's advice. But there are guidelines for this. And this bill does not change any of those existing regulatory parameters. It is designed to interface with those and incorporate them. But it could arise, and so there needs to be a mechanism within a direct healthcare agreement that would allow a physician to terminate the relationship if necessary.
Great, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Deamers, for being available to answer questions. So your answer with regard to the termination fee makes sense to me if we're talking about the administrative costs of onboarding someone. And so I'm looking at this subsection H here. It allows a termination fee in two circumstances, both the onboarding, which is subsection C, and subsection G, which is the, I believe, if I'm interpreting you right, is the sort of broader provision for the patient terminating the relationship. So if they have already recovered their administrative costs, hopefully through that first month or two of fees, you know, would it be so harmful to these providers if I were to, for example, if we were rather to, for example, limit it only to subsection C, not subsection G. And again, what I'm trying to do here is protect consumers so they are able to perhaps get out of these relationships in a way that isn't punitive to them. And I know the analogy has been used to gym memberships. I think that's a little bit, I think some folks might want to avoid that because gyms kind of make money by hoping you don't show up and continuing to charge you. And I think many of us have been charged by gyms that we didn't realize we were still a member of. And we're trying to avoid that kind of situation here. So would that narrower amendment be less harmful to providers in your opinion?
So through the chair, this is Pete Deamer, and Senator Dunbar, I do appreciate your concern and that question, and ultimately I defer to the sponsor, but in my view, elimination of that cancellation, of the permissive cancellation fee for a cancellation within subsection G would not drastically alter the in a negative way the framework. It would be a greater patient protection, and as you point out, you know, the upfront administrative costs are incurred early, and that's what the subsection C Charlie termination and termination permissive termination fee would be designed to address. So conceptually, I agree with you that those administrative overhead costs would already have been incurred and hopefully covered should a subsection G termination occur.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Deamer, for being with us today. I have a couple of questions. As folks are seeing the doctor when they don't have any insurance at all, how does their relationship work with a healthcare provider currently?
Well, for the record, this is Pete Deamer. Currently, well, first let me state this, that this bill is designed to work in conjunction with insurance. It is a direct healthcare agreement is ideally coupled with insurance. This type of direct healthcare agreement in other states, there's 33 other states that have specific legislation to this. Some states did not require legislation because their insurance statutes were structured in such a way that didn't require specific legislation. But this is designed to work with insurance. It works particularly well with patients who have major medical policies or high deductible type of plans. If a person does not have insurance today, their relationship with the provider is a fee for service, and it's just a fee for each service. They don't feel well, or they're asymptomatic, or they need treatment, and they go in and they receive that treatment, and they pay a fee for that specific treatment. The distinction here with the direct healthcare agreement concept is that this allows a provider to provide a menu of services, a defined menu of services for a defined periodic fee. And that allows a greater breadth of services at typically a much lower cost than the fee-for-service model.
Okay. I heard what you said. As folks are seeking out a doctor's services and seeking to get treatment for whatever malady that they might have, how do customers know the difference between what they're receiving as far as healthcare and what would be covered by insurance? Where is the line?
Well, I think the line is, it first, depending on whether or not that patient has insurance or does not have insurance. Right? So if the patient does not have insurance, well, then there is no insurance to cover anything. Under that scenario, right now, they'd be fee for service. If they had a direct healthcare agreement, they would be able to receive the menu of services for that defined periodic fee, which are all listed within a direct healthcare care agreement. That's a requirement of the agreement, so they know the menu. If the patient has insurance, the scope of the services that are provided by the direct healthcare provider are often different than that which might be covered by the insurance. For example, again, these work very well with high deductible. So those persons might be $7,000 away from their insurance paying $1 for a covered service, but yet they'll be able to access those same services, those same covered services for periodic fee, which I think we might have a practicing physician available to can speak to and their state as to what they charge, but something like $100 a month. So it would provide that greater access to these services before the insurance is triggered. These direct healthcare agreements are designed to increase patient access to care, particularly in the environment of the high deductible plans. Remember, in the insurance context, a deductible is designed to reduce access to care. It's designed to address what they consider a moral hazard problem. Right? And this is designed to bridge that gap.
Okay. Thank you for that answer. Kind of my line of thinking here, so you know and the committee knows and other testifiers know, is what I'm struggling with is people who have insurance or not, they go to the doctor, and they're able to negotiate with the doctor about what their fee for their service is going to be, whether they have insurance or not. And oftentimes what we've seen as insurance companies or self-insured plans increase the amount of money that they cover for, let's say, a physical or other basic care, magically the price of that basic care increases correspondingly. It's amazing how that happens. Mm-hmm. And so as you kind of go through this process, what I see here in this idea, and I've heard from providers, essentially you'd like to charge an initiation fee for someone having access to a medical provider, which is a fascinating way of improving access. Then you would like to charge a subscription fee for a person to gain access so that they can avoid having to pay money toward their deductible when they go and get treatment. And then the menu can be adjustable based on whatever the provider and the patient decide on what the menu of care options is.
Mr. Chair.
Let Mr. Deemer answer first, and then you can answer.
Well, Mr. Chair, I disagree somewhat with the characterization of this as being a fee for access. This is defined as a fee for a defined scope of services. It may include a whole menu of items, labs, well checks, sick checks. I mean, I believe that we have physicians available that can testify to the scope of the types of services that are available. So this is not like concierge medicine, where you're paying a fee for some sort of accelerated line pass, so to speak, for access. This is a defined scope of services for a defined fee. Now, there might be certain services that are outside a direct healthcare agreement that, you know, just are not contemplated as being within them, some sort of specialty service or some service that is just outside the scope, which then would revert to a fee for service. But it's not a fee for access.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just reading off of a document in front of me here that states that the patient pays a flat periodic fee, generally monthly, in exchange for routine visits and access to their healthcare provider. Senator Wilson.
Yes, for the record, Senator David Wilson. Yes, Mr. Chair, the idea is that you would pay a flat fee or you can pay a periodic fee. So if you just want to pay the monthly fee, you can pay a monthly fee. If you want to pay the yearly fee, you can just pay the yearly fee. The example, you know, Mr. Deemer said, this is more for the really the folks that are the underinsured folks, because you sort of have three populations. You have the insured, you have the underinsured, and you have the no insurance folks. Most folks that have the no insurance on that spectrum is going to be covered through other state programs that we have option. But the underinsured folks that may have either folks that may be either on Medicare or those folks that just have a high deductible plan. So you can just set up a time and fee. I mean, the best example I use is for a dentist. You can pay a dentist, hey, I'll pay you $1,500. And like I said, everything is negotiable. You can have your own negotiated rate through health care, through your own contracts, and that'll cover two screenings a year, every other year for x-rays. We continue this plan, and maybe a two crowns replacement or a filling. And so it's really an a la carte menu of services that you're basically subscribing to. So it's not going to be putting you in line faster or ahead of other folks. And this is just a supplemental plan that you could have. It's not insurance, but something that you could have to cover that cost, because you may only pay $2,000 and just need a wellness check every year, or, you know, maybe covers an x-ray or just the, so many wellness checks in a time frame. So maybe five wellness checks in a year, but you still have that major medical in case a catastrophic event happens. And so some people they never go to the doctor because they wait for those catastrophic events, because they can't afford to pay $8,000 out of pocket before their insurance kicks in. And even still then, it's only an 80-20 split for most of the time. And so you're still paying that fee, where this is, you know that set price and you know the services you're going to get for that period of time. So it could increase people to have access to medical professionals that would normally would never go to the doctor for anything other than their catastrophic care.
And one question first. Would someone's membership fee, would that go toward their deductible for their insurance policy? No, it would not?
No, Mr. Chair, that would not, because this is not insurance.
Understood. Senator Dunbar.
I'm hearing this might be insurance. just kidding. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in the prior committee of referral, there was a reference that the fees are often close to $100. And I don't know if that was a particular clinic that has been doing this or doing something similar to this, or that that's based on other parts of the country. And perhaps Mr. Demers can speak to this, but sort of similar to what the chairman is getting after. I don't really understand how a provider makes money at $100 a month unless there's some additional fee that kicks in, because I don't know what other people's experience is, but I don't know if there's any service you can get from a doctor in this state that costs less than $100. And so perhaps, there's only one or two, visits a year or something like that. But again, it's a little bit different than an a la carte menu, because an a la carte menu applies that you're sort of buying these things as they happen. But what you're describing is a membership fee. And then within that membership, you have access to certain number of appointments. Is it unlimited number of appointments? I think when we had this at the prior committee, I think one of the providers said that it was sort of unlimited access to certain services. And in that case, I just don't understand how this pencils for providers if it truly is just $100 a month.
And for the record, Senator David Wilson, and that was the average national fee for states that already practice this. And I think Dr. Umber can go into that a little bit in more details and sort of what he's seen across many different states. But there are many different healthcare specialties, healthcare providers. And so it's really going to be different for each healthcare provider. Your direct healthcare agreement could have that set price for these are your number basics of wellness checks, but this might be your set price per x-ray. And so you could have all these things. It depends on your agreements and how complicated the agreement might be or how simplified the agreement might be. But that is all left up to those individual providers to set those individual agreements.
And for the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, I think being able to charge such low fees like that is an example of how much money and time is being wasted on the bureaucracy of billing different insurances.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair? I agree with you that there's a lot of waste and bureaucracy in our health insurance system. That is you know, as clear as day, especially in this state where costs are so high. I am still concerned that there is sort of a mismatch between what consumers are going to expect from this and what is going to be provided if fees are that low. And I know, as the senator said, it's all negotiated, it's all clear, but we do know that, especially in the medical services, where there's such an asymmetry of information between consumers and medical providers, you know, we have to be really careful that maybe they thought they, this was covered, this was something that they could get, but it's slightly different. You thought exams were covered, but it turns out MRIs don't count as exams. It's a special kind of exam. Because certainly you're not going to get an MRI for $100. And so I think I'm just sort of struggling with that and how these economics would actually play out in Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Umber, Dr. Josh Umber, you are next. Please state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation.
Yeah, my name is Dr. Josh Umber. I'm a family physician in Wichita, Kansas. I've been a direct primary care physician for 13 years and one of the creators of the movement. Overall, I would say this is probably far more language than necessary, but I understand Alaska's been working on this for some time. Most states have far less regulation because direct primary care is not a separate class from other physicians. As mentioned earlier, we fall under all the standard state rules and AMA. To the senator's point that asked about the cost effectiveness of this, we charge $10 per month in kids, so far less than the $100 per month. We've been making that work for 13 years. To put the direct primary care value proposition into context, the membership is based on age only, not pre-existing conditions, offers a limited home visit for visit office visits to all visits, basically, you know, telemedicine, no quote base, 20% included free of charge, and medication allowed wholesale for up to 95% savings. If you combine that value proposition, you can help decrease insurance premiums for employers by 30 to 60%. So I think a lot of the detail about the DTC is getting lost in certain of the legislative minutiae.
Thank you, Dr. Umber. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Wilson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just want to reiterate, I think what Dr. Umber was fading out there and talking about some of the prices of the overhead, he's right. Looking at entities such as denials management for folks, a lot of the claims that providers send get sent back, and you do have to have a lot more staff to process those denials. We did a project for that for an entity in the state, and it can cost hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to process denials management claims for, and that's just a small health clinic off in Copper Valley. And so I think the cost savings that Dr. Umber was speaking about, it can be realized by just cutting out that middleman. And you, I think through direct healthcare agreements will help Alaska to get to the actual better cost of care without sort of the insurance companies or other folks. And that's the magic number that we've been trying to get to many years. To lower the cost of healthcare is going to take a banana clip of silver bullets. And this is just one bullet in that round to help try to figure out what is the cost of actual care in the state.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Umber, thank you for testifying before us today. So you said, I think you said in your testimony that it's $10 a month for your patients or for patients at the clinic that you run. And so can you explain what exactly do people get for that $10?
Yes, it's $10 for children 0 to 19, and 50, 75, or 100 per month for adults based on age, for unlimited home visits, work visits, office visits, telemedicine visits, no copays. Any procedure we do in the office is free of charge. Teaching biopsies, joint injections, ultrasounds, DEXA, spirometry, Holter monitors, casting, splinting, et cetera. And then medications and labs done in-house for up to 95% savings. In some cases, you know, compared to Walgreens, we're 99% cheaper. So the economics of this have been tried and true and proven. It will vary by location to some degree based on cost of living, but it's a viable model to practically reduce the cost of care, which then can help small businesses decrease the cost of insurance.
Hello?
Yeah, just to, thank you for that response, Dr. Umber. I guess a follow-up to that is now I'm even more confused how you make money. You know, $100 per person, $10 for a child with unlimited visits or these kind of services. I just don't understand how it pencils out for you. Do you receive direct subsidy from the state government or from the federal government? Is this sort of the primary care, and then it is referenced to specialists that you work with, and then the insurance pays for much more? This is like a loss leader, essentially, that leads to much more expensive care afterwards. I just, $10 a month doesn't seem like it would cover your costs.
It does. So this model's been proven to be profitable. We've helped over 1,200 doctors and 800 clinics launch in the last 12 years, growing by about 20 to 30 clinics per month. We do all of that consulting for free. The rough math, if you break it down, is $50 per patient per month, averaged out across all ages, equals $360,000 per year. For a family physician, with the aim of making between $200,000 and $250,000 a year and covering overhead for one nurse for every one or two doctors. Previous speaker mentioned about staffing issues. The average physician would have 5 to 6 staff each just to deal with insurance and overhead and volume of patients to see 30 to 40 patients per day. So it really is just a better, faster, cheaper, easier model. In the same way that I could rent one movie plus a late fee from Blockbuster for $10, I can get Netflix that has thousands of movies for $10. It's just a better mousetrap. If you go into it, I don't think the legislation's about the accuracy of the economics, but I can speak to all of that as needed.
That's all. Thank you, Dr. Umber. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Umber. Are there further questions? Seeing none, at this time, we are going to set aside Senate Bill 45 and take it up at another meeting on another day. The Senate Labor and Commerce Committee will meet again on Wednesday, March 29th, when we will take up a recap of Senate Bill 83, a new CS for Senate Bill 93, and additional public testimony on Senate Bill 88. As there is no further business to come before this committee, we are adjourned at 3:04.